suggest the opposite. People at the local level will be in a position to see that the standards are implemented locally. And finally, I was talk a little bit about, well, I guess not finally, two more things very briefly. One is accountability. This budget, this plan, reflects strongly what we believe to be a much more accountable plan of service for the Department of Education. Last year, we did an assessment of our services, where our services being used, by who were they valued, what did school districts like, what didn't they like that we were delivering. We made many changes as a result of that survey. We worked hard on fiscal accountability. We're working and have been for over a year on standardizing the school charter accounts so that we can position the entire public education system so it can be far more responsive. For years, the legislature has expressed concern that they couldn't make head or tail out of the fiscal reporting from school districts because they were using different data points. And we've standardized that to the point where we think it's going to be far more useful to you. We have also reduced our department level travel significantly in the last year. We cut it by some 25%. We're taking a very close look at that and trying to make the most of the resources we have. In terms of, and finally, I just mentioned briefly, one other thing that's of significance that I think we've accomplished this year is we, as a state, have a very healthy start on the Americans with Disabilities Act. Alaska, in fact, is assuming a leadership role nationwide in the implementation of Americans with Disabilities. And the executive order that, that our governor has advanced is, in fact, being used by other states as a model. So we should take some pride in the fact that we're working very effectively in that area. The budget highlights section, I think our FY94 budget is below the FY93 authorized budget by some $6.8 million. This includes, I might add, post-secondary commission in this figure. The Department of Education is down in our budget, six full-time positions, so we're making some further cuts there. The foundation program increases $18.6 million to reflect a 3% enrollment increase across the state. And the impact aid dollars, federal impact aid, we have an increase of $1.2 million there. We anticipate that we will need, for enrollment increases this year, a supplement of approximately $6.4 million. People transportation is down in our budget proposal by some $2.6 million, which will require proration of transportation funds. The state, or the department, has moved back and forth between fully funding people transportation and funding it as low as 90% in different years, depending on the revenue and final budget deliberations. We anticipate it will be somewhere in the mid-range between the 90% funding based upon the projection. We have implemented and are implementing many incentives for school districts to be more cost effective as we get into specific legislation and recommendations in subsequent meetings. We'll detail that out for you. And we have increased the professional teaching practices commission budget by some $25,000 to reflect their increased need for legal fees and support. Very briefly, I'd like to share with you the highlights of our legislative package. It's scheduled to be signed, the transmittal letter will be signed tomorrow afternoon by the governor. He's having a press conference on this at 1:30 p.m. We have four bills in our package that really address three important issues. The first is a kind of an omnibus bill. It has five parts to it. Part of the Alaska 2000 bill, it calls for a phase-in to a 200-day school year by the year 2000. It has another component, which establishes funding for school improvement grants to school districts. This ultimately is a way of using some of the funding that exists in the Education Trust Fund, the Public School Trust Fund, and moving that into the School Performance Fund, and then providing grants to school districts. It's aimed at research and development. We as a state have not made for many years any significant ongoing contribution to developing new programs. We believe that we must do this if we're going to make the changes we need in our system. And we're excited about this. We think we'll be able to document to your satisfaction the need for this and the results that we can provide. We also have a component in this bill which would establish advisory school boards in all districts. Currently, statute requires that REAA school districts must have advisory school boards. City and municipal and districts are not required to. This provision would, in fact, require that in all districts. We have, in addition to that, a component in the bill which would make changes in tenure for teachers. And the way it would change it is that we would focus significantly more attention on who achieves tenure. One of the criticisms of the tenure issue, as we focus on it, and it's been tried many years, there have been proposals for changing it. One of the constant criticisms is that we're giving tenure to people who shouldn't be getting it in the first place. If we quit doing that, it would resolve the problem. I think this proposal attempts to respond to that, and I think it does it so successfully. What we're looking at here is additional opportunities for local people to be involved in those decisions and to advise each school board in regarding decisions on tenure. We're calling for the establishment of committees that would include local teachers, local parents, and local students in this advisory capacity. Another component of our bill, and the final one, is also a significant component, and that is the charter schools component. The bill will detail that out and respond to many of the issues and concerns raised about charter schools. I would simply like to clarify at this point that charter schools are not a backdoor approach to a voucher system. They have no relationship to private education. The way we have it structured, it could not be used in that capacity. This is a public education alternative. It's as you will see, something that is determined locally. The local school boards have final decision-making authority regarding this. And I think it will go a long way towards responding to needs for more alternatives within our public education system that parents around the state have expressed. The second bill we have in place in our packet is basically aimed at making revisions in the Education Foundation Program. We worked long and hard at this. We were here a year ago, and we told people at that time that we would go out, work with the public, work with the school districts, and come back with recommendations for change. This is a very detailed thing, and we'll get into it later. I'll just touch briefly on the points that we've addressed in this. We have replaced the current area cost differential, which is with a weighted price differential called the Alaska School Price Index. We are proposing to change funding for gifted and talented and vocational education. Essentially, what we're going to do in both areas is deregulate them, allowing more latitude at the local level. We're decreasing the level of support for gifted and talented and increasing the level of support for vocational education, which ultimately will not affect school district budgets either positively or negatively, but will put districts in a position to have less reporting requirements to the department and a greater opportunity to use their resources for the direct instruction of students. The gifted and talented one is an issue which has really great interest. We found that if you look into it, that 38 states currently have deregulated gifted and talented in the very same manner we're proposing. We have in there a hold harmless provision. As we've worked through the proposed changes in the foundation, we found that some districts may ultimately lose some minor level of funding, and we found that would, in our mind, not be an acceptable way to enter this for a number of reasons. I'll get into that at a later time. But we've assured that no one loses money. This results in some additional cost, however, it's very minimal cost. We've established a forward funding mechanism. However, it's not being proposed in the traditional sense of other attempts to create forward funding by setting aside large amounts of money. We find two things. Number one, since our enrollment is increasing around the state, it's very unlikely that any district will incur a decreased enrollment. However, should that happen, what we're doing is putting in a second year hold harmless so that if one district's enrollment decreases, they will, during the subsequent year, they will be held harmless at the previous level of funding for 1 year, which will in effect give them the certainty of budgeting on a definite number, something the school districts, as you know, have argued for years and never have. We do not see that this will negatively impact the state's finances because, as I said, enrollment is increasing. So I think it's an opportunity to do something that's important to school districts without significant risk in terms of financial risk for the state. That's one component. Other things that we're addressing are local contributions. We're establishing a phase-in so that all school districts would phase into a local contribution between now and the year 2000. We're looking at also some areas, other areas that we're addressing are minimum school size, so we can take care of the problem of very, very low enrollment schools. I think we have a nice proposal there. We work with districts on that. And we're making some changes finally in funding communities. And we'll get more into that as we explain that bill to you. Our third bill, and actually the fourth bill too, are aimed at the CIP process. As you heard the governor say already, we're looking at a significant level of funding for future years. We're looking also, we're going to propose changes in the categories. Currently we have 7 or 8 categories for capital projects. We're looking at reducing those as we move into this program, because if we're able to significantly fund these, we will not need all of those categories. We're looking at some changes which will strengthen building codes for especially rural schools around the state which do not have them. We're looking at, again here, at a local contribution, a local match for all school construction and phase in over the years. We're looking at some other accountability things that will provide appropriate level funding for schools but will prevent school districts from overbuilding on state dollars. And also some controls on the design of schools and a much greater emphasis on preventive maintenance than we have. And the final bill is an appropriation bill that relates to CIP. So those are that is our legislative package. As I said, the governor will have a press conference and begin explaining that at that time. Other changes, there will be many other things we're working on. They will be done primarily through the regulatory process. So that concludes my opening comments.
Okay, thank you. We'll go on to Mr. Barnes, and then we'll come back to questions so that we make sure we get everybody's testimony in. Number two.
As you know, Drew and I have had a conflict of committees this morning, and I'm just getting on the elevator and asking
right.
If I come to, I try to let everybody know, it was the press conference of Mr. Jackal being on that pre-ethics committee. Sorry to break in here, so I may have a few questions later that he's already answered, or I may have, depending on the time, I may just wait to ask him for later. Thank
sure.
you.
Okay. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to introduce several of our staff at the Post Secondary Division, Doug Hanna, who's our finance director, Diane Behrens, who's a program coordinator, And I'd also like to introduce Jerry Lewis, who is the Executive Director of Alaska Commission on Career and Vocational Education. His budget is contained in our budget. The Alaska Commission on Postgraduate Education consists of 14 members. Senator Phillips, I believe, was just recently appointed to replace Senator Fisher. They meet four times a year. A great deal of their meetings result in hearings of student appeals, institutions who want to be authorized to operate in Alaska. The three functions of the commission are consumer protection, the institutional authorization, in which they have a relationship with about 130 institutions here in Alaska, and the Alaska Student Loan Program. Our function is the Alaska Student Loan Corporation, which is a five-member group. Consists of the Commissioner of Administration, of Revenue, of Commerce and Economic Development, and two of our members from the Post-Secondary Commission. Their single function is to secure funding through the bond market for loans to students. This last year, they initiated a loan program of $47 million through the bond market. The Commission manages a $500 million loan portfolio representing approximately 160,000 active loans. There has been an increase of 260% volume from FY90. The loans and repayment have exceeded from $20 million up to about $53 million receivable in FY93. Our budget highlights: the Commission's budget for FY94 is $8.5 million. Approximately 70% of that is in corporation receipts, which consists of loans and repayment, and interest off the bond issues that are generated in the bond market. About 30% of our funds are general funds used for Ritchie, Grammy, and student incentive grants. Our FY93 budget, $3.6 million, includes two RPLs. One was for staff to help revise accounts that transferred incorrectly during a computer conversion a year ago this summer. We believe this will be substantially completed by June of 1993. And the other one was recently passed is to increase communication with borrowers, both in written and phone contact. Both of these RPLs will disappear in June of 1993. Our changes from the 1993 budget to the 1994 budget is a request for six new staff to help largely in the communication with borrowers. Our overall net increase in the last 3 years has been approximately a 30% increase in loan volume. Just in this year alone, we've added 7,000 additional loans in repayment. The loans per staff ratio in FY90 was 3,000 loans per staff. The loans today are 4,400 per staff person, and it's going to increase to 5,500 if we don't get additional staff. Increased contact with the borrowers means increased collection. People tend not to want to pay if they're not in touch with the agency that's trying to collect that money. Our default rate, however, is promising. It's a little less than 7%. People pay in our state because it's lending largely to the middle class sense of responsibility, and the school systems that are taking the kids in are investigated and authorized to operate, and we have a much better success rate. Our cumulative default rate is around 12%, and the national average is closer to 20%. Our new system allows us to better identify borrowers. This last fall, we attached $6 million of permanent fund dividend checks, and we were able to notify borrowers of their probability of moving to default much more rapidly than we had in the past. Our capital budget, which you'll see as we proceed through the session, includes quite a bit of requests for technology to assist us in allowing borrowers to have a better relationship with their loan program. And that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chairman.
Good. Questions from Senator Petula?
Last year, we couldn't get the administration to support the $10 million need for putting us on fast track to solvency and into providing for an entity that will perpetuate itself. Now, this year there's no money, and I understand, for the money that you're going to need or would have needed if we were to meet the formula that was devised when we went to bonding and took it out of a different posture. Is that true? There's no money now, and I don't know how much of a gag we may be placed on you by your superiors, and I don't mean commissioners, but if there isn't any, I suppose we could go into executive session or something, but if there isn't any, tell me where we are now. It looks like in a few years this thing's all going to be gone if we don't put some money in it.
Well, there was a request came from the OMB to the legislature. I think the budget makers in our administration look at all the priorities, and the program is not going to suffer in the very near future by going to the bottom line. And there are some alternatives for us to either increase the length of time we pay back the debt, which does increase the debt load, but we can lay it into 10 to 11 year payback, we can 14 year payback. We can consider sometime in the future a loan program that possibly meets a need-based situation rather than available to all. There are some other considerations that say that in the year 2020 we might want to take a look at.
Chairman,
we're in very good shape.
Go ahead.
We full well know that we're destroying this program as it was conceived unless we put some money in. And we're late now. And I certainly hope that your subcommittee will get into that so that at least I know and all of us know that wish to what's happening, because I think it's rather horrendous and it's unfortunate this can be. And we were going to have what would have been a tremendous program. It's going to have to be radically changed, and the state's going to suffer ever greater debt as a result of not funding up front that to which we have committed. Obviously, one legislature can't commit another. But I just hope that this can be all laid out. I won't take any more of your time right now, but I don't expect Mr. Barnes to initiate, but he certainly has always been willing to answer the question.
Okay. I've got Senator Adams and then Senator Rigger.
My name is the commissioner. He mentioned under Alaska 2000 the legislation there and regulations, but I believe the first piece of legislation that the omnibus bill that he plans to support is setting up for failure, and because of the fact that it has five parts, which you'll have lots of disagreement on it, and that's a statement there. But my question is, under Alaska 2000, which portions do you plan to put on the regulation? And that's the first question. And then your appropriation bill, how do you plan to capitalize on that? Is that your own funds or is that other funds?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Adams, the parts of the omnibus bill, the first bill, that we felt would require statutory changes are included. Other recommendations which we advance will be coming out in the form of regulation. At this point, I can't recall what all of them are. But as we analyzed this, we felt that these proposals would definitely require statutory change. And we tried to reduce this package so that it had as few bills as possible, realizing that as it's addressed, there may be some changes, you know, in the bill as it's presented. We felt that would enhance, I guess, the overall strength of the package. In terms of the capitalization, the governor will be announcing tomorrow afternoon at the introduction of these bills the details of how he plans to capitalize them.
So you won't tell the committee then?
Well, at this point, I'd better wait till they give it to me. Unless I think, as I understand it, Shelby's asked me, but he's presented some overview of that to the committee. Is that correct?
To a degree.
Excuse me?
Not with.
Well, I thought he said he'd like the permanent fund earnings reserve.
I
could be wrong, but I thought that's what he said.
That's the level of detail that I provide you at this point. Is that
now? Okay, Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just one question. Back to the bonding for the student loan program. The loans, if I recall right, the loans are all put out at 8%. And what is the interest rate that you're borrowing at now?
The last loan was 11.6%.
So are you having to put any of the Student Loan Corporation's assets into a subsidy to either pay your operating expenses or interest expenses? Is that the gist of your exchange a minute ago?
Yes, all of our operation comes out of interest on the bond issue or loan repayment.
I guess question can I ask you? You've got all this money coming in at 8%. Unless there's some old loans still at 5 that are out there, but there's a 2% spread. So out of the 8%, 6% goes to pay the bond debt service. And the other two, are you saying that's insufficient to pay the cost of operating the corporation?
I would say it would be insufficient because we have write-offs for bankruptcy. We have defaulters who eventually write them off. And we're talking about 70% of this at least, or actually on a cumulative basis, 12% of this is never going to be paid back. You have 2%, well, it seems like a profit, if you will. It gets eaten up fairly quickly. In fact, we don't make money on this in the long run.
The 12% is because of forgiveness provision?
No, it's because some people just choose not to pay, and they'd rather go be bankrupt and lose their credit rating. They just aren't going to pay, they don't make enough money to pay the loan. They might be considered wanting the money in the first place. These are unsecured loans, largely to young people. Some of them lost as much as $45,000. You get out of school unless you get a pretty good paying job.
So your loss ratio exceeds your default ratio? That seems kind of hard to believe.
I don't think I can answer that. Loss ratio exceeds.
Well, you said 12% wouldn't be paid back.
We're estimating for the purposes of our operations that 12% loans we make will not be paid back. That's the basis on which the bonds are issued as well in the bond market. No one really expects student loans to get 100%.
No, I wasn't either, and I'm not trying to criticize. I'm just trying to understand you're expecting that 12% won't be paid back, but yet only 7% are in default. Those numbers, it seems like your default rate would be higher than your loss rate because some of those loans that are in default will pay, not all won't pay. So it seems like something bad.
7% is an annual rate. And they take it over a 10-year period and say, what if we factor in all these other considerations, write-offs, long-term death or disability and death, it actually adds up to a higher figure than 12%.
Okay. I see your finance guy shaking his head back, or nodding his head back. Okay, well, we can get into that in more depth. I think we should fully understand that. So, next I have Senator Sharp.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That was one of the things, that was my only point, is the difference between 12% and 7% would indicate that the larger ones aren't paying off, more of the larger ones aren't paying off than the smaller ones. If that's the case, barring other write-offs.
I'm not sure that is. I don't have information as to whether it's correct. The more money you borrow, the less likely you are to take it. I just use that as an illustration that there are some awful large loans, cumulative amount of loans out there. But I think we have the evidence that there is that.
Since you estimated 12% would probably not be collected, only a little over 7% delinquency rate, I would assume that if there is a tendency for the larger ones not to pay off. But anyway, we're getting that way.
Senator Kelly.
Does a bankruptcy discharge an obligation to pay back a state student loan?
I believe it does.
Is that federal law? Can that be reached through a state statute?
Yeah,
I'd like to federal that.
Pretty sure we operate under federal bankruptcy.
Okay, secondly, can somebody declare bankruptcy, get out from under $30,000 state debt to the state, and then collect a permanent fund check the next year?
I believe they can. And I believe they do.
Well, I think we should look at that, Mr. Chairman.
That's a good point.
Secondly, the total amount of school bond and indebtedness to state, the municipality indebtedness that the state is responsible for. I mean, it's dropping rapidly every year, which is the good news. What is the total amount out there that the state is responsible to pay off over a period of years?
I believe my finance director can answer that
question. Mr. Chairman, the outstanding obligation of the state in which the state shares is approximately $1 billion, which is the principal and the interest on the debt. It is decreasing rapidly. There is a schedule in the budget program that shows a decrease.
Okay, so it's $1 billion of bonds and interest out there that the state's responsible for, so there's a couple hundred million more that locals are responsible for.
Yes, the state share of the actual current year payments last year was $127 million. This year is just slightly less than $100 million.
And if we were to bond, if we didn't have any more school bonds, at what point do we zero out? That's probably in your
year 2012.
I have Senator Lincoln and Senator Curtillo.
I wonder, Commissioner, if you would go over again under the what you were referring to as the third and fourth administration bill on the CIPs for the local match for building, if you would talk a little bit more about the local match.
Chairman, Senator Lincoln, what we're proposing there is that the local match be based upon what we're calling an assessed value of property factored into the average daily membership. So what we have is an assessed value within each school district based upon their enrollment. An assessed value of real and personal property that MDCRA has done. And what we are proposing is this, that in school districts with an assessed value per ABM between or up to $100,000 would be phased in from 0 to 5% local match over a four-year period. School districts with an assessed value between $100,000 and $200,000 would be in a phase-in of up to 15%. School districts between $200,000 and $600,000 per ADM phase-in up to 30%. School districts with over $600,000 per ADM for each student would be phased-in up to 40% of a participating share over those 4 years. The actual schedule will detail all that out. That's generally how it works.
Mr. Chairman, the match then would come from the municipality or the community?
Well, it would come from the local school district. It could be the municipality. If it's an REAA school district, they could use other local revenues to come up with their match. Based upon previous audits, the information we have is that every school district, regardless of its structure, does currently have or has had in the past at least 5% of the revenue would be local match. This is achieved in a number of ways by interest earnings, local receipts, etc. And it also historically has been done by in-kind, and there's the potential for that in-kind service on the local match to help them achieve that.
Senator Tula.
Mr. Chairman, I'm very critical of what I see. This looks like it's going to take place, and with the new plans, I think 10% of the students will receive 1% of the 2000 funds. In MassSU, we have a lot of problems. They changed the various methods of funding our community. And I've got five questions here, but I'm going to give them to you and to the committee, and then I'm going to ask the commissioner to respond to those, because they are site-specific. They so much affect the district I represent. However, the answers will affect your other communities and your knowledge of some of the problems. So I'll get together with the commissioner and I'll get those answers rather than belabor it right now, because I didn't attend the first part. He may have answered some of them.
Okay. Yeah, we'd certainly like to have those answered with us.
Yeah, it's really screwing up my district, I think.
Okay. Are there other questions from committee members? Okay. If not, thank you very much for your presentations, and we'll look forward to working with you. Next, we have the University of Alaska. President Komsar is here, I believe. Take about a two-second recess.
Steve, do we have finance staff?
President Komsar, are you? Saw you a minute ago. Walk back out of the room. We'll stand at ease for just a second. Go ahead and proceed. We'll try to get organized.
I'd like to thank the chair and the members of the committee for the invitation to join us today. It is always a pleasure to talk about the University of Alaska. More importantly, I've been looking forward to the opportunity to thank you for the support you have given to public higher education. the University of Alaska would be far less of a contributor to the culture and the economy of the state if it were not for your strong support and guidance over the years. All the people that come before you, I imagine, speak strongly in support of the programs they represent and feel deeply about their program's importance. I will be no different. I think that today's investment in the university draws a blueprint of Alaska's prospects, just as certainly as the lengthening days of winter sketch the coming spring. Public universities like public schools, bridges, roads, airports, and harbors represent the community investing in itself. They are a community's contribution to the vigor of its future and define to a very great extent the coming quality of life and work of commerce. In putting together its fiscal plan for 1994, its budget request, the Board of Regents of the University of Alaska recognized that the university is an institution that will define the future character of Alaska and its citizens. It is a guardian of tomorrow and an insurance that Alaska will remain a haven to us and our children and a home for our grandchildren. As a public land-grant institution, the university carries the tradition and ideals of public service, of applied and basic research, of instruction in the mechanic arts, as well as in letters and science. The University of Alaska has three essential and separable missions: to challenge the talent and energy of its students by offering exacting instruction in an extensive range of crafts and disciplines, to be a fountain of scholarship and creativity in the sciences and the humanities with a heavy concentration in those fields that are of importance to life in Alaska, on its land and in its oceans, to serve the culture and commerce of the state through instruction and performance and presentation of the arts, and by serving the applied research and instructional needs of industry. If these missions sound too universal, we do enclose them with a heavy layer of reality. The regents, the faculty, and the staff recognize that the range of obligations flowing from these missions can never be fully fulfilled, that we can't meet every individual hope and aspiration. The university must be able to grant access to post-secondary education to every Alaskan who has the energy and talent to benefit. It cannot, however, provide access in every discipline, nor provide the preparation necessary to enter all professions. Its organized research efforts, applied and basic, must be limited to very specific disciplines and questions within those disciplines. Its public service mission faces the same constraints. The university needs to ration its resources and focus its efforts on those aspects of commerce and culture that can most benefit. Foremost on the region's agenda is not how much to ask the legislature for, but how much can the university do for itself. At a recent retreat, the regents discussed the imperatives of intercampus coordination, consolidation of articulation. It has examined national models of instruction, maintenance, and library operations to ensure that the university is running efficiently. We are examining instructional workload and administrative productivity, and how to generate more university revenue apart from the general fund through federal initiatives, management of our land, private fundraising, and tuition. The importance of these efforts to make the university more effective and to increase the support it receives from non-state funds will become more and more obvious over the next few years. None of these actions, however, preclude the necessity to seek additional general fund support. The Board of Regents' fiscal year 1994 budget request seeks additional funding for the university to meet only the most imperative needs. In total, the regents request somewhat more than a 12% increase in general fund support and anticipate a greater percentage increase in other than general fund income. In examining our costs, the regents also state that they are asking for 80% of the increase, with an expectation that 20% will be made up by increased efficiency and effectiveness. The general fund support is to permit the university to do the following. First, to maintain an able and experienced faculty and staff. Of all the elements that need to be combined to make a substantive university, none has a greater influence on its quality and effectiveness than do its personnel. A university, as with all schools, is a labor-intensive institution. We need equipment and library books and buildings and computers, but it is the quality of the people that make all of this work. The region's budget request will allow a 3% increase in compensation and enable the university to meet expected increases in the state's retirement system. Second, the board's request seeks to challenge, although not meet fully, rising prices. The university is facing increasing costs in multiple areas. Utility prices keep rising, as does the cost of the day-to-day material needed for maintenance and custodial duties. The cost of equipment, service, and maintenance contracts are increasing, particularly in computing. Escalating costs in library acquisitions continue to outpace even those for medical services, and there is no end in sight. There are two major gaps in the current university financing. One is the operating budget for instruction, the major need being at the University of Alaska Anchorage. The other major need is to increase the operating budget for maintenance and renewal of its physical plant, the major need being at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. In its fiscal year 1994 request, the board seeks your support in both areas. Therefore, the third feature of the request is for building maintenance, renewal, and replacement. The university has over 4.5 million square feet of office, housing, classroom, and laboratory space. We currently spend about $11 million a year taking care of it. This is half of what is needed given any reasonable evaluation of the cost of upkeep. The region's request seeks to begin to bring this program into balance by increasing maintenance expenditures by a little over $3 million in fiscal year 94. This would be the first part of a multi-year program. The fourth request seeks to enable the university to meet its instructional obligations at the University of Alaska Anchorage and its student service and instructional obligations at the University of Alaska Southeast. Over the last few years, ever since the university was restructured, UAA has been growing in student enrollment and student demand. The terms enrollment and demand are not redundant. I wish they were. I use both because enrollment has not kept up with demand, and we are turning away students at a time when we should be inviting them in. Every time we close a class, reduce the number of offerings, or limit the disciplines we cover, we are closing access. The result is, at times, students going out of state. More often, it results in far fewer people getting the kind of preparation they need for work and civic responsibility. The chances of the university are working hard to maintain and indeed increase access, but it can't be achieved without building the full-time faculty at the University of Alaska Anchorage. The Student Services and Instructional Programs of Southeast have made a number of successful strides, but need further support, particularly in those activities that bridge student services and academic activities. Budget theme for 1994 carries forward the theme above. It seeks funds to enlarge the programs of the university to meet the growing demand. It seeks funds to ensure the quality of instruction and student and academic support. The University of Alaska is facing exciting times. They are exacting as well. The demand for university services is increasing. By the middle of this decade, it will be exploding. The reason rests in our population growth, in the changing nature of the state's economy, and the global importance of the piece of land we occupy. More Alaskans are choosing to stay in the state for their college education, and more Alaskans are choosing to go to college, as virtually all entry-level jobs require some form of post-secondary education. Similarly, public service needs of the state are expanding as people seek assistance in the development of small businesses, assistance for technological changes, and assistance in handling the stresses and strains of everyday life. Added to all this is the potential for funded research. Research opportunities abound as the University of Alaska discovers itself leading the growing national interest in the Arctic environment and global warming, in economic cooperation with the Russian Far East, and economic competition with the nations of the Pacific. This is the time to build the University of Alaska, and with it, the potential of all Alaska and all Alaskans. Thank you very much for listening so patiently. I will be pleased to respond to any questions. The three chancellors of the university are here today, and they would be happy to respond to, or even if they're unhappy with it, they will respond to questions as well. So we're here to answer any questions that you might have.
Other questions from committee members? Senator Adams?
Mr. President, I voted against the appropriation for that Senator Stevens had gotten the $25 million. And it's a $3 million for program receipts, and I didn't think that we needed that. I thought that perhaps that might be better utilized in water, sewer, housing in the state of Alaska. My reason behind that is since 1946 in Fairbanks, we have a geophysical institute, and for decades we have been studying the skies, the auroral systems, and the ecosystems that goes along with that. And sure, the sky changes colors, it's wonderful, but I didn't think you needed that at this particular time. Can you assure this committee that no general fund can be used for the operations of this supercomputer for the future?
I think I can assure the committee that when we received the original contract, the first draft contract from the Defense Department, in the acquisition of the supercomputer, there were a number of clauses in it that became a great concern to me and to Chancellor Wadlow, because there was a potential cost to the state and the state budget. That is, the $25 million is enough funds to operate the computer center without using a penny of general funds for about 2.5 years. And the question became, what was going to happen after those 2.5 years? If things go well, and I expect them to, the supercomputer installation will be bringing in enough income to more than pay for its operation 2.5 years from now. But if things don't go well, what do you do? So we have inserted a number of clauses in the contract, and this is a contract that has been approved by the federal government, that gives us a lot of escape hatches. I refer to it as the ability to unplug the machine if there is any potential for financial drain on state resources. So the way it is constructed now, the contract, and by the way, I have no difficulty negotiating this with the federal government. As soon as we asked for it, this was given. If it turns out that we cannot manage that facility, so it pays for itself, and it is in no way of general benefit to the state or the operation of the county, if it is going to be a drain, the program would end and the machine would be return to the federal government. By the way, there are a number of federal agencies that would love to have this particular computer in their installation. It is a remarkable instrument. It is not only a powerful supercomputer, it now has the largest memory of any supercomputer that seems to exist on this planet. My sense is that this is going to be a very exciting program, not only for the campus, but I think for all of Alaska. It really is going to be doing very interesting work. It will attract scientists from around the country and around the world, and indeed will play the same role as any export industry, that what it's going to be doing is bringing funds to the state of Alaska, jobs to the state of Alaska, and it's going to create a lot of opportunities for our students to study in areas that they would otherwise have been precluded from. I hope in a few years you will be sorry you didn't
But we still have capabilities. We have 4 centers that we can utilize. And I know the complaint has been with the university system that the speed of 50 kilobits or something per second is a problem. But we have the capabilities without the supercomputer with 4 different centers. Isn't that correct?
We now use a number of centers around the country to do that supercomputing on. What these centers do not have is the type of memory unit we're going to be able to establish. This supercomputer will look for a particular niche in the market, and that is for very large databases. For those of you who've been up to Fairbanks recently, or even for the last couple of years, you will see this enormous dish sitting on the Geophysical Institute building. And it is following a satellite, back in 2 satellites now, that are using a totally new way method of seeing what's happening on the planet. It's the Synthetic Aperture Radar System. This is part of an international program that may ultimately cost as much as $40 billion, not including the amount of money that's necessary to send these satellites into the air. The 2 satellites it's now reading from, one is from the European community, the other is a Japanese satellite. The American satellite will be going up at the turn of the century using this particular methodology. We are part, the University of Alaska in Alaska, is part of a major and essential intelligence gathering network. The intelligence is not for defense or for potential conflict among nations, but is for defense of the planet and the atmosphere and the environment. And I think it is just an enormous role for us to be playing, and one that's really going to be very beneficial.
Senator Petrullo?
Mr. Chairman, any of my questions will be more appropriate to subcommittee. I have a couple that I'd like to ask. Now, one is, and this is a political question essentially, but are you going to raise student tuition this year? Is your plan
in the budget proposal of the regions, there is a proposed 10% increase in tuition.
And do you have an escape hatch for average to good students if they don't have the funds? You know, I hate to see an open door for the rich to go to school, you know, and what are we doing about the others, so to speak, that don't have scholarships and don't have these things? There's a good number of students that fit in this category that are very productive, very good students, and some become excellent students. And that worries me. And nobody put me up to this. I'm just...
No. But I'm concerned sure about that, too. And I think access is very important. And particularly because access... To prevent access because of financial reasons would be moving against the entire history of the country and the history of the state. Right now, there are two things that are really helping us. One is the student loan program in Alaska. It is an effective student loan program. And it is really one of the best in the country, if not the best. You add to that the financial aid that can come from the federal government, and there are strong loan packages. At the same time, over the last year, each of the chancellors have increased their allocation of funds to student support. So if you look over the expenditure pattern of the university from fiscal year 2 years ago to the last fiscal year, one of the areas that has grown most substantially in terms of relative increase has been that area which goes for student financial support. The compelling reason for it is that last year we had a 16% increase in student charges, and to prevent the loss of students because of cost, we wanted to ensure that we did have those funds available. They take place very often in the nature of tuition waivers.
That's what I wanted. Get into that a little more later. It concerns me if we have a mass university. The university provides masses of an educational opportunity. We do so, and we make every effort to do so. Your capital budget needs just to keep the campuses going, not new needs, not new construction. What are the absolute minimums? I know you have them listed, but you know, leaky roofs, plumbing, electrical, those things that we've ignored for years. Some of us thought we were providing funds for them, but one way or another, they didn't get utilized the way we had assumed they were going to be. It predates you, so there's no, you know, there's no beating.
That's that problem predating me. Right? Yeah. Defense areas. We really have.
Now, you have some of them.
Yeah, we have two major areas. One is in the in code compliance, and that is the most immediate needs of the campuses, and that's several million dollars. I don't remember the exact figure. I think it comes up in the top of the capital budget request. Code compliance here is $6,600,000. Second is a very
statewide.
Statewide. The as you would expect, most of the problems relate to the oldest facilities, and the oldest facilities are on the Fairbanks campus. We then have about $150 million need for what is the price of deferred maintenance. And the proposal was to go into a five-year plan to handle the deferred maintenance problem of the university. There were two reasons for developing the five-year plan. One is, of course, the political reason, and that is it's hard to think of getting all the money in 1 year. But the other is that there is a certain rate at which you can absorb and really work effectively on expending funds for developing your infrastructure. And we felt that the expenditure of about $30 million a year was something that not only was possible, but something that was absolutely required if we were going to capture the problem. So we have a code compliance problem of $6.6 million, and then we have a deferred maintenance problem that we look at between $30 and $40 million a year. solve that. We have had discussions with the executive about perhaps using a bonding structure in order to get at the kind of deferred maintenance issue.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for another question, and that is, again, being somewhat site-specific, but it's statewide. Do you see any lessening of the emphasis of the regents, yourself, on the program initiated by the legislature so many years ago to bring the campuses to the people, the community college programs and so on? Are they occupying the same percentage of funding that they originally did? Are they improving in their funding? That's bound to save you a lot of money and needs in dormitory and so on if we have these programs adequately, or at least as adequately as possible funded. And some I know have very large student bodies. Do we have that emphasis? Do we continue that emphasis, or is it kind of being lost?
I'm concerned about that emphasis because I think it's very essential. My analysis of the last couple of years is that we have been maintaining that particular standard. If you look toward the future planning, and this was one of the topics that was discussed at great length at the last Regents Retreat, I would expect that over the years there would be an increase in the expenditures that were made in order to reach people around the state, indeed in every corner of the state. But we're looking at changes where there's going to be a shady line between what is being done to reach people 500 miles away and what is being done to reach someone 30 feet away. Let me try to explain that.
Sure.
We're looking at a whole new area of technology and some interactive television processes that could really strengthen our academic program. But you could use that technique to get programs out to the villages, to get them to Bethel and the villages around Bethel. You could use the same technique to get programs to people in Anchorage and in Fairbanks and in Juneau. And what we will be attempting to do is not only increase the availability of education at a distance, but at the same time to enrich the programs that are available at every site, whether it's a rural or urban location. Chancellor Lynn is chairing a new task force for the university that is going to be reviewing all the approaches that we are now using for distance education and trying to push the frontier of that and begin to define distance education as media delivery, not just delivery of something 500 miles away or 1,000 miles away. At the same time, there's a major proposal that Dean Gabrielli from the Fairbanks campus has been working on in the hope of being able to attract some federal funds to support the infrastructure that would be necessary to operate the program. That is, can we somehow get from different agencies of the federal government, not necessarily St. Louis, but combined effort, support for a program for let's say, $4 million or $5 million of capital investment so that we can develop this interactive system to cover the entire state. So my feeling is there's going to be a greater investment on the part of the university on this, that the results are going to be an increase in quality of the program and the availability of the program throughout the state, in urban areas as well as in rural areas. One of the reasons, I mean, compelling reasons for doing this, there are three compelling reasons. One is ultimately this would lower costs. Second, and perhaps more important, is that it will enrich and enlarge the nature of the academic program that students can receive wherever they're located in the state. And the third reason is we're going to be facing an increase in student demand over the next, over the remainder of this decade, and it should be a very large increase in student demand. The only way we're going to be able to meet it, unless you can think of some way of doubling our budget very rapidly, the only way we're going to be able to meet it is by using some of these technological changes and advancements and getting the faculty fully involved.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'll stop this because others have questions. But we played with the Plato system for high schools using APU. We played with the idea of the average teacher going to bush schools, but with these aids of telecommunication, of satellite and of cassette, that we could put a first-class program, and then the average teacher could, quote, average teacher could be of great assistance in making sure the students were there, attendance, and some explanations of for questions after the programs were shown and lessons were taught. I hope you come, I hope your program is far more sophisticated than anything that's been done to date, because I don't think any of those were effective. I mean, they just didn't last, they just didn't produce. And it's a whole new world out there. I'm sure something can be done in the non-laboratory sciences and collaborating arts programs like you're speaking of. But I think they're valuable. So far, I haven't seen much that's occurred at the high school level of value.
There's been a rocky record. I think that we're talking about the work not only in the humanities, we work in hard sciences too, and I think that the British have had a great deal of success in delivering deep correspondence, laboratory work. One of the things that has really hurt, at least within the university, and we just speak to the university, the delivery system at a distance, is the process of financing its infrastructure. That is, you can go back over time and you can find faculty that put a great deal of energy in creating these programs, only to see the quality of the equipment deteriorate over time, or not have enough funding to be able to purchase the next generation of equipment. And the end result is, I think we lost, and this is not just in the state of Alaska, it's throughout the
country. Are other states doing this effectively?
Yes.
Quotas and so on?
Yes. I think that you find a very effective program right now in Nebraska. Is being picked up. I think the most effective program is in the Open University in Great Britain. They have done this for the last 20 years. It's a remarkably effective program. And there's a lot that we can borrow from them, and there's a lot we could have to do on our own because we have different situations. But yes, there have been effective programs. And I think we'll be able to pull this one.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Kelly?
Could you tell me where physically the following campuses are located? I really don't know. The Northwest campus?
It's in no.
Rural College?
Rural College is a description of a whole group of campuses, and those are the extended campuses that are tied to the Fairbanks campus. So the campuses in Nome, in Kotzebue, in Bethel are all part of what we call the Rural College. Rural College is a bureaucratic title, but it is also a very, very effective entity. One of the things it has done, going back to this distance education, is get these extended campuses to work together so that material produced for distance education on one is shared throughout the region and by all of them. But the concept of Rural College is not a location, but it is an academic structure.
Kuskokwim?
Kuskokwim is in Bethel.
Interior?
Interior is located in the region around Fairbanks.
In the region around Fairbanks? Is it on the Fairbanks campus?
The office is on the Fairbanks campus, but there are centers, UConn, Aleutians, throughout the interior and all the way down
to Delta. Did I hear Aleutians? Anyone like the Aleutian Islands? So is this another bureaucratic title? I'm trying to. There is no little campus called Interior.
There's no single place that you would say that's the Interior campus. It is a title for a whole extension groups. But that's also true with Kuskokwim, because they will be working with a number of the villages in the region. So though you will find a campus there, its work is extended out over a long geographic area.
Chukchi.
Chukchi is in Kotzebue.
Bristol Bay.
Bristol Bay's in Dillingham.
And the Cooperative Extension Service?
That's throughout the state. Its headquarters is located on the Fairbanks campus, but it has an office in Anchorage as well.
Yes,
in
Lebanon.
What's its function?
The Cooperative Extension is an old traditional federal program. It's one of the first programs in the university, and it delivers a whole host of services in the area of agriculture. It delivers some know-how. It delivers programs like 4-H, Phillips programs for the homes and nutrition. It is a general support program for the population. It is and can be one of the most effective social service programs in any state, because what it does is provide information to people to help themselves. It also now, extension programs throughout the country are now picking up more work with small businesses and groups like that to be able to give them information on how to get loans, how to do international trade, how to purchase and things like that. But its original structure was really to work with agricultural communities, with rural communities, with families in terms of child care, health care, nutritional care. It provides advice and programs of instruction.
Thank you. Senator Lincoln?
I also have a question that ties in with what Senator Curtula was asking about, and that's the distance delivery. I'm a product of the University of Alaska distance delivery system, and went through a number of courses, including biology, in Rampart, a village of 63 people. And I swear by that distance delivery. I don't feel that I went to the University of Alaska Fairbanks campus as well as in Rampart, and I did not feel that the quality of education that I received through that distance delivery diminished any by being in Rampart. In fact, it was much harder, and I think I learned a lot more being out there. But knowing how that system works, I always thought that the statistics that we have of rural students graduating and going on to college is improving, but it still is relatively low in comparison to the total population of the state. And I always thought that if we could share, the university could share the library facilities, access to the library facilities, because we had access to it through the computer system, through the teleconferencing, that we could excite students in rural areas to go on to higher education. And it didn't seem that with the technology that we have before us and continuing to improve, that would be that difficult. I just feel we need to get our high schools more involved in the university system through the distance delivery. And as students can go from Lathrop High School right now and go to the University of Alaska and take some courses, I think that we need to do more of that also in rural Alaska.
And your remarks are so on that we've been trying to think of. In talking about an investment in this technology, the capital investment would be necessary, that would be a shame not to share it throughout the educational system, that for the university to use it just for itself would really be limiting it. That we really thought for three functions, for almost was for university delivery, the other was really for high schools and maybe even elementary schools. But a third was for the faculty to be able to communicate with each other. In fact, I think it was a little over a year ago, Senator Adams, I asked him to arrange a meeting for me with the governor to talk about using some of the Exxon settlement money in order to build just this kind of infrastructure around the state. As it turned out, the Exxon settlement money is constructed in such a way, it's written in such a way, that it really wouldn't be applicable to this whole state type of thing. But the idea of putting in a technological backbone that would support not only the university's educational work, but the work of K-12, and indeed to develop a spirit and a core among the teachers and faculty that are in rural Alaska would just be very, very beneficial. And that's the direction we'd like to go. And in fact, that is the search for federal funds that's being conducted and orchestrated on the Fairbanks campus, but is working through the whole university, is really an attempt to do just that. And if we're able to get funds for that kind of capital investment, it would be shared outside of the university system.
I might just add that because of that distance delivery, we now have a teacher in Rampart who is a local person from the community that went through the distance delivery and completed it on campus in Fairbanks, would not have done that if it had not been for distance delivery. Another one that has her degree, her bachelor's in business, and is going on for her master's, and that's as a result of the distance delivery program.
I must say that each of our campuses right now, lot of organ distance delivery that takes place. It's an anchor. They have great job courses and they really deliver services throughout the state. Fairbanks campus as well, and you know, what we're attempting to do with Marshall Lynn's committee and some of the other work that's taking place is sort of organize the university so that we're getting more from what each campus is doing right now, with the hope that the whole is going to be greater than some of the points.
Senator Pearson.
Thank you. We have a couple of questions. And Senator Lincoln touched on the avenue I was going to take. I wonder what sort of cooperation we have with the school districts throughout the state in terms of facilities sharing. And you mentioned rural campuses and Interior College with a number of different offices, plus a property extension on the whole list, and I think there are others out there that don't even come in that. What sort of cooperative efforts do we have presently in the school districts?
We really have a number of efforts taking place from each of the locations. I think the ties here in Southeast from the Juneau campus through the system is strong. That the Fairbanks Education Program is one that's tied to the regional schools there. That we have in the Anchorage Educational Program ties to the schools there. I must say, this is an area where I think the university has to do a lot more. And one of the areas that we're working on and we need to really begin to move is how to develop closer ties through the K-12 system. It's a lot of this, of course, would be self-service. The quality of the students that come to us will change the kind of work that we have to do. Right now, the university offers a lot of work in developmental education, and a lot of things that I think should have been done at the high schools and the primary school. And if we can work more closely with them, I think that we will all benefit. We have not made the kind of progress in that area that I think we would be comfortable with. If you'd like, I will develop some more information.
I would like that. I'd also know in terms of the physical. I'd also like to know in terms of the physical plant. What sort of cooperative efforts we have? Where are we using school district facilities for this university outreach in some of the rural areas, or versus where have we erected and/or leased space just for the university? And what I'd actually like, there is a bewildering number of university facilities throughout the state, just trying to keep track of a lot of different programs. It's great that we have them, but I'd like to have a list if we could. It'll tie in with our capital budget questions of where the facilities are for each of the.
We not only share facilities with school systems, we very often share library facilities with communities as well, in attempts of, so the public facilities are better used and that we don't duplicate the public facilities. We also have some very good summer programs for high school students. It's a way of bringing them forward and getting them interested in higher education and helping in their development. So there's a lot of work going on, and we'll try to get those cataloged in terms of what we're doing the way we'd like to.
Great. That ties in beautifully with my next question, which is, are there statistics, and if so, could you make them available to us about the changes over the past 20 years, say, in what entry-level skills or what, I guess, academic level skills are necessary for entry-level job positions. I know that when I graduated from high school, I and my classmates were able to go into entry-level positions for the high school with diploma. I know that now many of those same jobs are requiring a college degree, and so I've never seen any statistics on that. I assume that they're out there. I also wonder how much remedial work the university is finding itself having to do product coming out of the high schools in the state to be able to bring our university students up to a
graduate
level.
We have a large investment in developmental work. I think more on the Anchorage campus and elsewhere, but I think it may be the same proportion actually all the time. I can, the university itself does not maintain that information on job requirements. The education is necessary, but there have been a lot of publications coming up, particularly federal government, but also private sector publications. And I will be happy to get that
stamp. Okay, my all-time favorite question to ask the university. How are we doing on transferability of hours from campus to campus and program to program?
I think that we're doing far better than we were a couple of years ago. Right now we have full transferability when it comes to the core curriculum. The students that study the core curriculum on one campus can be on others. Your difficulty takes place in certain forms of the majors. The place I'd like to get to is having a common cost numbering system throughout the university. We're still a couple years away from that, but that would not only allow for greater transferability, but I think it would give more information to the students about what is required on different campuses and how they're meeting it wherever they are. So we've made a lot of progress, and this is important too.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, are there other questions? Senator Duncan.
On the capital budget, this is kind of like you said, the capital budget request was already submitted by you to the governor's office change. I've heard Mr. Stassi's explanation of that. I wanted to hear yours.
Okay. We submitted capital budget, as we always do, to the executive branch. And in the capital budget, we had listed what we considered our best estimate, and they were a good estimate. So what would be the full cost of each of the projects, particularly the projects that were going to represent the closing out of a building program and the completion of building. When the capital list came down from the executive, it was a far leaner list than we had been hoping for. When that came to my desk, I began to look over the cost that we had put into completion and asked my staff to look at what we might delay in the completion process. I'll go back to what I mean by that is, if you have a parking space, how much will it cost to flatten the land but not pour the concrete? What will that save us? If we finish the Butcherovich building and we don't buy any new furniture, but we're willing to use some of the orange crates and so on that we've had for a while, how much money could that save? And in fact, I made this a very serious attempt. This was done in order to be able to generate a pool of funds to meet some of the capital projects that we thought were important but were not covered in the governor's list. And going through that routine, we came up, I think, with something like $3 million. And the primary purpose of that would be to cover a building program on the Juno campus that had been in the list of the trustees for a couple of years that we thought was important to get done in order to fill out the campus. The question then became, the governor's approach was to complete all buildings. The university approach, which was to complete 90% of them, complete them up to the point where they were useful, but not necessarily have every piece of hardware in place. And that became the difference between, I think, the two groups of members.
Mr.
Chairman,
I have to be more specific there. Is it your recommendation and the region's recommendation that the UAS factory wing addition was to be funded? And if you were given $19 million to allocate my machine, are you standing behind that project? Is it your recommendation that project?
It's mine. It's not the region's. The regions have not met since the governor's budget came out.
So it's never died on the region's priority.
Yes, the original, but not based on the $19 million. But yes, on the original list, that project was not only supported by the administration, but also supported very strongly by the unions.
Maybe I can just ask, what's your position at this point? The change apparently was made in the governor's office, and I'm just interested in seeing if you're continuing to advocate for the reinsertment of that $3 million for UAS pass-through wing, or if you, what's your position at this point?
That's my position. It's to advocate for the unions. But I also understand why it was rejected. I did advocate for that. It is my position, and indeed the systems office position. It is not one that the regions have taken.
Mr. Chairman, I don't mean to continue this. I just want to be clear. You say it's not one the regions have taken. The regions have had this on their list as one of the top construction projects for many years. Is the commitment from you, is your commitment firm that this is a necessary appropriation, capital appropriation for this year?
I think it's important capital appropriation this year. The reason I'm not saying it's the regions also said that the other building should be fleshed out. I mean, in with the list that the regions voted on had the numbers attached to them that the governor's list has attached to them. I went back to the governor with a different approach, which reduced the regions' numbers on a number of projects so that we could generate the funds for the Juno project.
Mr. Chairman, of course, the regions' list, before you got to any new buildings, would be much, much greater than the $19 million. So the regions then haven't approved any of this, is what you're saying, of how you allocate the $19 million. Is that what you're saying?
Right.
not sure I'm getting a real strong answer. I'm sorry, but I was assured by...
I don't know if I could be much stronger. I thought that I came back to the governor with a proposal that I was much more comfortable with. And that proposal was to spread the funds in a somewhat different way so that we could push forward the Juneau project, because I think the Juneau project is...
Just one moment. Have you formally asked the governor to reinstate that project? And you have not, would you be doing that?
I discussed it with OMB. I discussed it with Shelby Smith, and I discussed it with Pat. I have not had a meeting with the governor.
I would suggest that you meet with the governor. I'd like to see actually a request to the governor's office to reinstate the project. And I thought I had those, almost those assurances from the financial officer and others. So I would encourage that.
Okay, are there other questions? Senator Cthulhu.
Last year we suffered a veto of the initiation of that project, apparently. I would certainly like to see additional funds provided if we start reallocation. I would say that those projects, including the one that I've been following for many years and had great support for, wouldn't yet get chippied on and then fail to be completed. I'd like to see support from the administration, from the Board of Regents, for increasing the funding levels so that any other projects not presently listed by OMB would get constructed, but again, would impact those that are already on that list. And I think that's important.
Chairman, I guess that's what I was suggesting also. I mean, I'm not trying to suggest that, although they're already chipping in this country, too. Yeah. On page 72, they dropped a letter out of the name. Let's get started.
No.
Did we do that? That's terrible.
No, that's not true. That building is being changed to the D-U-N-C-A-N building.
Oh.
And thank you very much for the funding.
Okay, are there any other questions from the committee or other members of the Senate? Okay, thank you very much for your presentation.
Thank you very much.
Okay, next we have the Department of Health and Social Services, Commissioner Mullen.
Holy guy. That's the problem with this one time you use meat. At least they think they put a roast out there.
Give me 10 minutes.
I'm going to initiate, and I'm ready to go, please. And I'm going to do it.
Oh, yeah.
Get out any longer than that.
Please proceed with your presentation. We'll try to hold our questions until the end so that you have an opportunity to complete your overview.
Good morning.
And then we'll get into questions.
My name is Ted Mahler. I'm the Commissioner of Health and Social Services, and with me I have the directors of the different divisions of the department. Just to remind you, and for those that don't know them, who they are, I'd like to begin with Janet Clark, the Director of Admin Services. We have in the department two major divisions. One, on direct services, we have on the back of our handout on overview on the last page is an org chart. And we have two deputy commissioners, one for direct services programs, Dr. Brian Taylor. I'm actually just stand up so you know who they are. Director of Family and Youth Services, Deborah Lane. Director of Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division, Lauren Jones. Director of Mental Health, Developmental Disabilities, Margaret Lowe. And Director of Public Health, Dr. Peter Nottingham. And for the financial programs, the deputy commissioner over them is Jay Lively. Director of Medical Assistance, Kim Bush. And Director of Public Assistance, Jan Hathaway. Thank you. So those are our senior staff for the department. As you see from the org chart, there are a number of different committees and commissions and boards that also report to us, and our legislative assistant for this session is Mr. Elmer Winston. The Department of Health and Social Services, as you see from the budget overview, has a rather large budget with a lot of general fund and federal dollar participation. In the first page of this overview of the 94 in the front, you will see that the from the governor's budget request, the TF is $429 million, and the total overall funds, federal and interagency transfers, $756 million. I think because of the seniority of the people here, you probably are familiar with most of our programs, and unless you want me to go into more detail of what programs every division does, I'd be glad to do that, or maybe just go into some of the budget highlights of the...
I would concentrate on the budget highlights.
Great, good. The first graph that you see here, we put them on a purple piece of paper here, refers to just kind of outlining the amount of general funds we use and other funds, how we leverage different funds to come up to our budget.